vacationer's dream. Until now.
Imagine a squid with tentacles 30 feet long.
Oh my God.
So this thing has two whips. Those whips are covered with suction cups the size of this notebook. The squid grabs and impales its prey with those whips and drags it towards its beak, shredding the flesh as it goes.
Terror runs deep from the author of Jaws, Peter Benchley's The Beast.
Okay, so Peter Benchley might have taken a little artistic license there, but the recent discovery of a 700-pound specimen is still pretty amazing. We'll be talking about that later on in the show. But first, this afternoon, President Obama is expected to announce a new military and medical response to the Ebola epidemic in West Africa. The plan includes 17 treatment centers with about 1,700 beds to be set up in Liberia. That's one of the countries that has been worst hit by the epidemic. In addition, the military is expected to send up to 3,000 troops to help coordinate the response. The Ebola virus has infected more than 4,000 people, and it's killed more than 2,000 so far. Joining me now is Dr. Jack Chow. He's a former U.S. ambassador on global health and a former assistant director general at the World Health Organization. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello. Well, the WHO and Doctors Without Borders have been pleading for help for many weeks now from Western countries. And do you think this response has been too slow in coming?
Well, the response, as indicated that the president will commit, is vitally needed aid for those who are suffering from the virus right now. I think having an earlier response would have been very, very beneficial. But the reality is that the president is aiming to commit this type of force, medical intervention force, now. And 1,700 beds is a significant number of units to help save those people who are currently infected from dying from the virus. So it's a major quantitative as well as qualitative advance.
And is it enough, though? This is targeting mainly Liberia, from what I understand, but this virus has been apparent in other countries in West Africa.
A regional approach is definitely needed. It will remain to be seen what the president announces later on this afternoon, whether the president intends to extend the initiative to the other two countries, Sierra Leone and Guinea, or ask for other international partners to join in the fight. Guinea, one of the heavily affected countries, is a French-speaking country, and a country such as France, with the cultural and linguistic ties, could certainly make a difference with its own advanced healthcare units. So we're going to have to await the president's announcement and see whether it will be a primarily American approach, or will it be a stepping stone for a broader international coalition.
Right. Well, so far, why hasn't that happened? Why hasn't the United Nations coordinated a broad international response?
The UN has appointed a special coordinator, Dr. David Nambaro. The crux of the problem is that the UN and the World Health Organization does not have the authority to provide direct care and treatment in these countries. It's a policy that the WHO and the UN asks the countries to implement health care. We're seeing that Ebola has broken that business model. I say that it is akin to leading a fire department without firefighters and asking homeowners to put out the fires when that happens. So the big question going forward is, can we take the lessons from Ebola, the failure to respond, and craft a new international system of intervention and mitigation, mm-hmm. Specifically against what I call flashdemics, these rapid outbreak, high lethality pathogens like Ebola.
One of the parts of the plan is to give 400,000 home treatment kits to people in Liberia so that they can treat people at home. Do you think that's a good idea? I mean, these people aren't medical personnel.
It is an open question. The virus is such a rapid transmitter from infected people to another, and even for trained healthcare workers, donning this protective equipment and making sure that you take all necessary precautions while taking care of sick and dying people is a challenge. To ask lay people, ordinary citizens, to put on such equipment will require a great deal of education and outreach. And I'm afraid that without such education and outreach, you know, such assistance, while well-intended, may go to waste and may actually perpetuate the virus when they try to take care of a sick family member, but they don't put on the equipment right, they themselves are at risk.
Okay, so hang on. Let's bring in someone who is there on the ground. Sean Casey is the Emergency Team Director for International Medical Corps. That's a humanitarian organization with offices here in L.A. He joins us from an Ebola treatment unit in Bong County in Liberia. That's about 4 hours from Monrovia, the capital. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to be able to talk to you. What's your reaction to the president's plan? Do you think it'll help you?
I think it's desperately needed. This is an extraordinary situation, and it calls for extraordinary measures, and that's what President Obama proposed today, or will be proposing today. We're really kind of falling behind in getting control of this epidemic, and we need all hands on deck. So we view this as a very positive move.
Can you describe what's happening there in Bong County and in other parts of Liberia? I've read accounts of people dying outside hospital doors in Monrovia.
Right. So until a couple of days ago, there were no available beds in the entire country. Every Ebola treatment bed was occupied. And the demand for the beds was far outstripping capacity. So we've seen in Monrovia, where all of the beds still are full, people waiting outside, self-presenting, people coming in ambulances and having to wait for hours or being sent home because there are no beds available. Until yesterday, when International Medical Corps opened this Ebola treatment unit that I'm at right now here in Bong County, there was only one unit available outside of Monrovia, the capital. So there's an enormous need for more beds and more staff and more gear to be able to care for patients in Ebola treatment units as they're set up.
So you also don't have the healthcare workers, and the ones that you have, are they trained properly?
So Liberia had a shortage of healthcare workers to begin with, and the Ebola outbreak has created a need for many, many more. So it's not just about the staff being available, it's also about having them trained and having people trained to don personal protective equipment, PPE, which is the coverall suits that you see people wearing in photos and on television. Learning how to put those on and take those off is complicated. It's about 30 steps, and the dressing and undressing time can be up to half an hour to do it correctly. So just being trained in that part is complicated, but also understanding how to move when you're in personal protective equipment, how to interact with patients, how to keep yourself safe. It's quite complex. So that takes some time, and time is not really something that we have a lot of at the moment. So it's a challenge in finding staff, getting them trained, and getting them deployed to work in Ebola treatment units as they open.
So where are these trained staff going to come from? Where could they come from, conceivably?
Right. So some of them are here in the country, and they just need to be mobilized to come to work and trained. And we're doing that, and other organizations are doing that now. There will be a need for foreign medical staff, especially because Liberia has very few doctors that work in clinical practice. So there will be a need for doctors. There will be a need for nurses coming from other countries. We're now operating with an expatriate team of around 15 from Kenya, from the U.S., from Spain, and we're going to have to continue recruiting globally to be able to meet the needs there.
Well, what's been the response? I mean, in other disasters, in Haiti, for example, there was a flood of response from doctors and nurses who wanted to go over and help from the United States and elsewhere. What's been the response to this epidemic?
It's been much more cautious. It's been very challenging getting humanitarian partners to engage in Ebola because of the risk involved, and because until now, really, only one or two organizations worked on Ebola. So the organizations that normally respond to humanitarian crises don't really have the in-house expertise to manage Ebola, particularly in terms of Ebola treatment. So, I mean, in our case, International Medical Corps hadn't worked on Ebola before. We had some infectious disease experience, but we had our staff trained by MSF, by Doctors Without Borders, before we initiated services here. And so there needs to be a process to exchange, to transmit the knowledge that exists in a few hands to other partners so that they can take on these roles.
But is this a case where public health professionals are needed more than doctors per se? Because once someone has Ebola, what can a doctor actually do?
Right. So there's actually not a lot of medical care to be provided. The clinical care is very basic, but there is a need for doctors who understand management of health facilities and who can also care for patients. About half of the patients that enter Ebola treatment units recover, and so there is medical care to be provided. What we really need is a huge cohort of nurses and trained infectious control specialists. Who can manage the sites and keep them clean and manage infection control within Ebola treatment units. There's also a need for more epidemiologists, for more managers. I mean, there's nothing that we have adequate supply of at this moment in time.
So how dangerous is it for someone to come over there and help? I mean, are you afraid for your own health?
I'm not. There are risks involved. Particularly because most of the healthcare services, the normal healthcare services in Liberia, are not functioning. So if a staff member falls ill with malaria or is in a vehicle accident, they have no place to go, essentially. That's the greatest risk. Our staff in working in the Ebola treatment unit are trained before they ever begin work in the Ebola treatment unit. They have the best equipment available and follow very, very rigorous procedures to prevent exposure. So at this point, the people working in Ebola treatment units in Liberia and Sierra Leone and Guinea who have been trained and who have proper equipment are the safest health workers in these countries. So we can really limit risk, and there are almost no cases of people working in healthcare workers in Ebola treatment units that have been infected.
Can you just describe a typical day there at the clinic?
Right. So today was our first full day operating the Ebola treatment unit. We accepted our first patients last night. We had a father and son come in yesterday evening. The son died about 5 minutes after he was admitted, and the father is still here. This morning, we had our ambulance pick up two brothers. Their father was a healthcare worker in Monrovia who was exposed in clinical practice and died, and they both began displaying symptoms a few days ago, and we brought them here today. The team put on PPE, personal protective equipment, admitted both patients, and have been caring for them throughout the day. And in the meantime, we've been planning supplies, planning additional staffing. At this point, we only have three patients in the unit, but at full capacity, we'll have 70. So we're in the process of recruiting staff, planning staff rotations, organizing training, and getting all of our ducks in a row to make sure that we have everything we need in order to scale up.
All right, I want to go back to Dr. Jack Chow for just a moment and ask you this. The European version of the CDC came out with figures saying that if this outbreak continues at the current rate, the number of cases could reach 250,000 by the end of the year. That's just in a few more months. Is this thing completely out of control?
There's a real risk, and that's why the president decided to act. And what is, as Sean vividly points out, there needs to be healthcare capacity brought in immediately. Without that help, it could very well exponentially grow, not only within West Africa, but it's already There's been one outbreak detected by the WHO in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, as well as in Nigeria, which is an oil power. If it continues to propagate throughout the continent, there is risk for continued spread and the humanitarian crisis worsening. So the European CDC numbers, as well as what CDC, WHO itself has been saying, that this is a long drawn out battle. We need to equip the front lines of good people like Sean with personnel, supplies, and training. We need to break the transmission cycle, as Sean points out. You know, with care, 50% survive, and once the symptoms abate, the virus is deemed clear, and they can go home. But you can't release them too early because they still may carry the virus.
Isn't there also a fear that the virus may mutate and may mutate into something that's airborne?
There is that ongoing concern. I think that the acuity in this virus killing patients vastly outweighs the risk of a virus right now, the mutation of this virus. Right now, there are 5 species of Ebola known to man. It may take a while for a new species to evolve, but in the meantime, the chief priority is to save lives.
All right. I want to thank you both very much for joining us today. That's Dr. Jack Chow, professor of global health at Carnegie Mellon University. And we spoke to Sean Casey. He's the emergency team director for the International Medical Corps. And he spoke to us from Liberia. Thank you both very much.
You're welcome. Yeah.
Coming up, the fight between Frank Gehry and Washington, D.C. over his design for an Eisenhower Memorial on the National Mall. That story is coming up next on Press Play. We also want to know what you think of the story we just did. Should the U.S. be doing more to help combat Ebola? You can give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or weigh in on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
You're listening to Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Dwight D. Eisenhower was not a controversial president. He was a war hero, an aisle crosser, a moderate, well-liked politician. His official memorial on the National Mall, though, that's proving to be a different story. Construction was scheduled to begin 2 years ago, but instead, the design by architect Frank Gehry is still being fought in D.C. Frances Anderton is here to tell us about it. She is host of KCRW's DNA. That's a show about architecture and design. And she's here now. Hi.
Hello, Madeline.
Well, describe this design Frank Gehry did for this memorial. What does it look like?
Well, let's just say that if your image of Frank Gehry's buildings tend to be rather flamboyant and curvaceous, this is not what you're going to get in this design. This is a 4-acre, essentially a park, that has as its main features a central area where there will be statues to Eisenhower. But really, the distinctive features that have created a lot of the controversy are what Frank Gehry is calling tapestries. And this would be quite large, essentially woven stainless steel images that are suspended between tall, concrete, unadorned columns.
And why did he want to do tapestries?
Well, he became interested in tapestries because he saw how they had a role in our past as storytelling vehicles. Mm. And he felt he wanted to find a kind of unifying way of telling the story of Dwight Eisenhower. Tapestries, one could also think of them as sort of friezes, are a motif of classical architecture. He wanted to do his own take, essentially, on classical architecture. So he chose to take the motif of the storytelling tapestry, make it very large, turn it into essentially sort of translucent screens that would form a kind of a wall around this park on which would be depicted stages in Eisenhower's life and places that are synonymous with his growing up and evolution in the landscape of his childhood.
So far, so good. What's the controversy?
there's so many elements of this that inflamed people. Initially, people responded very well, it seemed, to this design. And certainly the people who were to make the decision on the Eisenhower Memorial Commission. But the first backlash started, I think, to depict Eisenhower in a statue as a small boy. Frank Gehry has become a student of Eisenhower and was very aware of wanting to tell the story of Eisenhower as someone who came from humble beginnings and rose to become this great general and American president. And one of the ways he chose to do this was by depicting Eisenhower as the barefoot boy. This enraged people. Then the tapestries enraged people because critics saw them as sort of physically clumsy. They felt they were inappropriate architecturally in a number of ways. They had all sorts of issues with their practicality and how they would fit in to the cityscape of Washington, the Pierre L'Enfant plan.
Well, what about his critics? Are they complaining that he's not getting the story of Eisenhower correct?
Yes, yes. The implication is that Frank Gehry is somehow dishonoring Eisenhower by making certain choices, such as depicting Eisenhower as a young boy. However, Philip Connicutt, who is the art and architecture critic for the Washington Post, who's been following this for years, says one of the ironies that has sort of emerged from this lengthy process is that now Frank Gehry, one, has developed a huge regard for Eisenhower as well as knowledge about the man.
So he's become an expert in this whole process.
He's become an Eisenhower expert and admirer.
Very few people have really understood the depth to which Gehry has studied Eisenhower and has a very particular take on Eisenhower's accomplishment. He feels very strongly that by incorporating this tapestry, which connects Eisenhower to his roots in Abilene and connects him to the humility of what Eisenhower himself called a barefoot boy who went from being quite poor on a farm to being the president of the United States, that he's trying to honor that in as deep and respectful a way as he can, that's really gotten lost in the fray.
So he decided to accede to the critics and get rid of this image of Eisenhower as a barefoot boy and depict him more as a military hero?
Well, the barefoot boy became 17 instead of a boy, and there are going to be statues and depictions of Eisenhower as a military hero, absolutely. But really what the major change that has now been made, and this is what is coming to a head this week when Frank Gehry's design goes before a commission tomorrow, is that for him the tapestries are the central unifying feature of the scheme. He has taken away two of the tapestries and some of the columns, and that has... it's denuding the design. Congressman Darrell Issa, who is with the U.S. House Oversight Committee and the National Capital Planning Commission, he has gotten involved. People are not sure whether he's trying to help sort of kill the project or trying to move it forward. But whatever, he has urged Gehry partners to show two schemes, one of which has the lesser number of tapestries and one of which has no tapestries at all. And for Frank, the tapestries have been a deal breaker. No tapestries. He says he's going to take his name off the project, and who knows what might happen then.
Because without the tapestries, what do you have? Columns and trees? I mean, you don't really have anything.
You have columns, trees, and you have statues. And that's what he would say himself. And that's what now, ironically, his critics are saying himself. I should say that I saw a mock-up of these tapestries, and really, they were beautiful.
And there is also some criticism over the cost, that the cost has ballooned while this has dragged on, that $40 million or so has been spent on this so far. A portion of that, a third perhaps, has gone to Frank Gehry. And that there isn't enough money that's been raised to cover the final cost of the entire project should it be built.
Well, obviously, I don't see their books. I don't know how this money has been spent precisely, but one can see that there is a design ready to go. It's not that the office has been sitting there with its feet up. They have worked now. This process has dragged out, which obviously builds in extra costs. But they could start building this memorial tomorrow. With all that, there has been so much dispute. There has been so much name calling flying around. It's been an incredibly fractious process. And it has sort of stymied what would have been a fundraising process underway right now.
This is not new for Washington. It took 40 years or so to get the FDR Memorial built. We remember the controversy over the Mai Lin Vietnam Veterans Memorial. People just thought that was an outrage. And now it's probably one of the most, if not the most, visited memorials on the Mall.
Absolutely. And I'm sure that supporters of Frank Gehry's design would say Exactly. Remember what happened with the Myerlin Memorial? Everybody wound up loving it. That's probably true, too, of Frank Gehry's design for the Eisenhower Memorial, were it to be built.
So, as you said, there's a key meeting tomorrow.
Tomorrow there's going to be a meeting of the Eisenhower Memorial Commissioners at which they will review both Frank Gehry's compromise design, which has less tapestries and columns, as well as an alternative that has no tapestries or columns. This is in response to Representative Darrell Issa, who wants the Memorial Commission to present alternatives then to the National Capital Planning Commission on October 2nd. The saga continues.
Okay. Frances Anderton hosts DNA, KCRW's show about design and architecture. And you can hear more about this story today at 2:30 right here on KCRW. Frances, thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up on the program, the San Joaquin River is the lifeblood for a lot of California and the rest of the country. It provides water for nearly half of our fruits and vegetables. One man kayaked the 400 miles from start to finish. He'll tell us what he discovered after we get a news update with Steve Chiotakis.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. California's second longest river runs 417 miles from the Sierra Nevada mountains near Yosemite to the San Francisco Bay. And while it may take second place as far as length, the advocacy group American Rivers recently named it the most endangered river in the country. The threats: over-engineering, over-diversion, and just plain old overuse. It was these threats and the idea that a river could die that inspired CNN's John Sutter to travel the river on kayak and sometimes on foot.
To get to know the river at its own pace, on its own terms, to meet the people who depend on it, and to find out whether this dead river could be brought back to life.
John Sutter is an opinion columnist for CNN, and he joins us now to talk about his journey. Hi there.
Hi, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Well, one of your lines, it's a preview piece to this project, you say that in California, water flows uphill to money and power. What do you mean by that?
Well, this is a phrase I heard over and over and over again when I sort of parachuted into California. And I think it means that the state, more than any other, has engineered water to do whatever it wants. So essentially, you know, the north half of the state is rather wet. The south half is pretty dry. And California has engineered its water system to move that water towards sort of powerful interests, in a lot of cases, agriculture or large cities. So the San Joaquin River, you know, flows through the Central Valley of California towards a lot of large agricultural interests. And it's those interests, in large part, that dry up the river. And they're the reason it doesn't make it from its source in the mountains down to the sea.
But it's those interests that feed a large portion of this country their fruits and vegetables.
I think that's true. And I think that's one of the many really interesting contradictions about this river. So it's a hugely important waterway. The Central Valley of California grows something like 40% of a lot of fruits and vegetables that the U.S. produces, 80% of the world's almonds. It's clear that this industry matters and matters big time. It's a very fertile region, too. I think it was surprising for me to hear that industry was so important to the state in its history that this river has been like permanently overtapped. You know, it basically becomes a desert for about 40 miles in its midsection. And I found that just very, very surprising as an outsider. It's not something I realized about the San Joaquin River. So I think, yeah, the industry is hugely important and does need to exist. But people who are looking at the spreadsheet sort of overall, you know, a lot of sort of the even-keeled heads on this issue are saying that water use needs to be cut back somewhat, yeah, including agriculture.
Right, because agriculture in the state uses 80% of the water that we have. Let's talk about your journey, and you began not knowing how to kayak. So why did you decide that you wanted to do this if you didn't even know how to kayak?
So I wanted to get to know this river sort of on its own terms. And I get that that, you know, might sound a little goofy, and I was definitely naive going into this. But I thought the best way to do that would be to try to travel down it. I mean, in essence, and this has been true for a long, long time, but a river is a story, right? It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It connects people, you know, with all sorts of different interests in very different places. And I thought the most interesting way to get to know this river would be to start at the beginning and try to go all the way to the finish. But, you know, I found all sorts of interesting and sometimes scary roadblocks in the way. From at the start in the Sierras, the river is so wild that there are only a handful of people in the world who ever have navigated parts of it. It's heavily dammed in the mountains and, you know, near Fresno. It's dry at its midsection, so it sort of, you know, becomes a desert as it's overtapped. And then, like, going into the bay, it's, you know, a very wild and choppy and sort of dangerous waterway again with, you know, these enormous tanker ships and whatnot.
But did you really start at the top where it is really scary and only a few people know how to navigate it?
I went up there with a pro kayaker, Darren McCoyd, who is one of the very few people who actually has ever navigated parts of that river. And so we saw it together, and I hiked the headwaters, which is at Thousand Island Lake up in the Sierras near Yosemite. And Darren told me about, you know, parts of the river. One part is nicknamed the Crucible. It's sort of three passages that you can't spot from the sides because the cliffs are too high and there's no way to hike up to look down. So you sort of have to go into it blind. And the way he described one of those turns to me, at any given moment, there's sort of three small channels that the river would take. And one of those three would send you plummeting into a pile of rocks. And you would definitely not be in good shape after that happened. So after talking to him about how wild the river was up there, I avoided that section, hiked to the top, saw it, learned about it, and then sort of I got in the kayak for the first time below Fryant Dam, which is the largest of the dams on the river near Fresno.
So you just decided
I chickened out on that part.
Having never been in a kayak, maybe I would try that for later.
Yeah, I think you would need like decades of experience and a lot of guts. I mean, it's pretty nuts.
Okay, so you get in around this dam and you have a pretty good time. It's you get the hang of it, right? And you master the kayak. And then you discover, as you've alluded to, that the river runs dry. Did you know that you would be, you know, in swampland and then in desert when you decided to go down this river?
I'd done enough research to know that it did dry up. So I had some kind of contingency plan for that. But how far that was and how completely dry it would be, I really did not have a sense of. I mean, you get to the end, there's sort of a small dam called Sac Dam that's really not near any town on a map. Like a lot of the Central Valley is pretty uninhabited and not very traveled. Within like about a mile of walking from that point, you know, it becomes just a complete desert. I mean, it looks literally like a desert. I saw, you know, sort of like dead crustaceans, like stuck in the sand, the cracked earth effect. And it was, you know, 3 days of hiking across that desert to get to, you know, the place where the river would come back.
What
so
did
I didn't
you do with
realize
your kayak?
Quite how severe it was. I left it in a parking lot. There was someone living nearby who was kind enough to let me leave it in a parking lot. And I caught a ride and came back to get it later.
You actually encountered quicksand, which seems like it's like right out of a Lord of the Rings movie. Well,
yeah,
tell us about that.
It does. So I wasn't even sure that quicksand was a real thing that was outside,
yeah,
you know, of Lord of the Rings or Indiana Jones or stuff like that until I was stuck in it. So I was by myself. The river had just sort of come back. I was after that desert portion, and I thought that there was enough water to get back in and kayak again. So I'd started off. It slowly petered out again, and then yeah, I was just sort of walking along in this almost dry riverbed, and I just started sinking in. And, you know, it was like bubbling quicksand, like you would imagine like a children's book or a movie.
Scary.
And it grabbed onto my legs. It held me in tight. I talked to a guy later who's a fish biologist and who's out in environments like that, you know, quite a lot doing sampling. And he told me that he essentially dislocated his hip in a similar situation in the Central Valley. So I was lucky that I wiggled out. It took me a long time, though. That was, I think, the most physically exhausting part of the trip, for sure.
We're speaking with CNN opinion columnist John Sutter about his journey down the San Joaquin River. And it really does sound like a Huckleberry Finn, you know, Mark Twain adventure, because you meet all sorts of characters who live along the banks of this river. And you call it this other California that we don't really hear much about or see much about. And tell us a bit about some of the people that you met.
So I think one of the more interesting people I met on my trip was Walt Shubin, who is an 83-year-old farmer. He has a very small farm at this point. I ended up staying with him because the San Joaquin is like a very privatized river. It's very hard to find access points that are public. It's hard to find places that you can camp. So I made contact with him and ended up staying with him for a night. And I'm so glad that I did, because I got to sort of step back in time hearing his stories. He told me, you know, about growing up in the Central Valley. His parents were immigrants from Russia. He said that they slept outside at times. They were working in vineyards and on plantations, and just had a very rough, very poor childhood growing up. And I think that that's led to him appreciating the area and what it's been able to provide for him very much now. But he remembers a time when salmon ran up and down the San Joaquin. And the way he remembers it, they were so thick that you could almost sort of skip across them on their backs, like across the river. Which, you know, I thought, oh, that's sort of a, like an idealized memory. But, you know, you talk to biologists and they say that there were, you know, something like 200 to 500,000 salmon that used to inhabit this river. And they're functionally gone now because it's not connected. Further down, I met another older guy, Bill Connor, who was living on this houseboat near Stockton in the delta of the river, and had sort of tied the houseboat to a barge that he had sunk so that he would have some stability. And he was one of the people who I thought depended on the river in like the most literal of ways. Like, he actually drank from it sometimes with a little bit of bleach, he told me, for safety purposes. But he, you know, fishes from the river. He grew up on it, and sort of having those Huck Finn adventures that people grow up reading. And I think that, you know, I guess it's no coincidence I mentioned two of the older people who I met on the river, because I think that they're the ones who really remember when this river was alive and healthy. And I think that those days of sort of Huck Finning a river, like those Huck Finn style adventures, are mostly gone. I think our rivers are largely invisible. I met people all up and down the river who were even fishing in it, who didn't know where it came from, where it was going, or, you know, that it ran dry, in some cases like tens of miles from where they were.
There's a lot of opposition to Jerry Brown's tunnel proposal that would divert some of this water down south. And when you go up there, you see a lot of these say no to the tunnels signs and things like that. Did you meet a lot of people who were angry about that?
Yeah, especially in the Delta region near Stockton. There was one who pops to mind named Lynn Miller, who was, she saw that I was posting on Twitter. I was sort of live tweeting this 3-week trip down the river. And she could tell from my tweets where I was. And she waited on her water pump, essentially sort of maybe 20, 30 feet up off the river. She waited for about 2 hours for me to come by. And she was standing up there and she yelled, "Are you John?" You know, sort of down from above. And I was just sort of shocked at first, like, how does anyone out here know who I am? And it's a common name. It must not be me. But she was, you know, there looking for me. And she was standing right next to this sign that said, "Say no to the tunnels," or one of the tunnel, you know, opposition slogans. And I think in that area in particular, there's a strong sense that the Delta, the California Delta, has been used every which way by all parts of the state to the point that it's not benefiting the people who live in that area, or the fish, the ecological life that depend on the Delta. It's so heavily engineered. It looked nothing like what I expected it to. I expected this sort of web of wetlands. If you look on Google Maps, it looks like this lattice. You show up in real life and it's, you know, all these rock-lined channels. So I was very surprised to the degree to which the Delta is already highly engineered. And I think people there are very fearful of any further engineering and are fearful that their sort of importance in the state water system also will be reduced.
So you make it to the end, right? You make it to the bay.
I did, yeah.
So what did it feel like to finally make it to the end?
It was sort of, I was about to say a flood of emotions. It's a horrible metaphor, but it was a lot of conflicting things going on in my head. One, I was overjoyed that I made it, because there were definitely points where I thought this might be over. I don't know if this is possible. It was incredibly hard getting through the San Francisco Bay and out to the Golden Gate Bridge. It was a very windy day, high waves sort of crashing into my chest or like over my head in some cases. I was in a sort of a two-person tandem kayak at that point. Otherwise, I absolutely wouldn't have made it. A guy, John Dye, from a group called Rivers for Change, was with me. So, it was physically exhausting. And then I also thought back on someone I met at the very beginning, Darren McCoy, the pro kayaker who, when we were up there hiking in the mountains, he said something to me that really stuck, which was that I'd sort of looked down at the river and it was making this sort of roaring, like rumbling sound. And I said, "Oh, it sounds like a highway." And he said, no, highways sound like rivers, actually. And so when I was going under this massive bridge, under the Golden Gate, you know, sort of hearing the cars go across above me, that sort of popped into my mind. And it really made me realize that my mindset and the way that I see rivers had really shifted. I think that there's something, a new world that opens up when you have a river first view on the world and you use them to sort of map out how things work. I think it's a very foreign way of thinking these days.
Well, John Setter, thank you so much for sharing your trip with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
It was my pleasure. That's John Setter. He's an opinion columnist for CNN, and you can read his incredibly long but incredibly well-written and well-worth-it account of his trip down the San Joaquin. We'll have a link to it at our website, kcrw.com. Well, back from his voyage. I don't think you were kayaking down the San Joaquin, but anyway,
you're back. We did not kayak down
the
San Joaquin, but we did kayak on Tamales Bay up north of San Francisco.
Well, okay. Yeah. I stand corrected. Warren Almey
is here
now.
Well, I wasn't on the San Joaquin. You were right about that.
Half right. Okay. I'll take it. 1 o'clock. What's up?
What is up is the president's strategy for dealing with ISIL, ISIS, the Islamic State, whatever you want to call it, and testimony today before the Senate by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, indicating that just maybe there might be the necessity of using armed soldiers in combat situations
on the ground.
On the ground. Yeah, despite what the president has said, he couched it in very careful terms, said that this would only happen if the alliance didn't come together and so on and so forth. But, of course, the alliance isn't coming together.
Yeah.
So there was a lot to talk about. And how has this also, how fearful Americans have become of ISIS and the extent to which there's a kind of war fever in the country now. And it shows up in the polls in a very interesting and dramatic way. It's beginning to sound a little bit like the way things were before Iraq.
Everything old, new again. Warren Almey is back in the chair at 1 o'clock. And to the point, it's great to have you back.
Thanks.
And coming up on this show, what happened when researchers dissected a 770-pound squid? We're going to find out next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Earlier this year, scientists trawling Antarctica's remote Ross Sea hauled aboard a real-life sea monster, a 770-pound colossal squid. That's a lot of calamari, though it's not the record holder. The largest giant squid ever recorded may have weighed nearly a ton. Still, the opportunity to examine one of these astonishing creatures is rare. And it's just not just scientists, not alone, who are fascinated. Something like 142,000 people from 180 countries watched the dissection live online that took place this week. Stephanie Bush studies squid at the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute. She's here now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. Well, were you one of those 142,000 people watching this dissection?
Yes, I was, actually. I was able to watch part of it yesterday.
And what did it look like?
It looked like it was in a very large tub of water. It had, of course, been frozen since it was caught. And so they had it in a large tub of fresh seawater to thaw it out so they could look at the various parts. It actually was in really great condition for one of these squids because a lot of times, so all squid and octopuses have very fragile skin. And just by, you know, manipulating them, catching them in a net or on a line, and then also the process of freezing them and thawing them out, they actually can, that top layer of skin can get scuffed off. But this particular individual actually, for whatever reason, had a lot of that skin still intact. So that was really cool to see. It's kind of this deep purplish red, at least at this point.
Now, these things have been the subject of fascination for a long time, maybe the subject of horror films, and you know, it wasn't entirely certain that they actually existed. When did they first become apparent?
So actually, the squid that was dissected yesterday live was a colossal squid, and they actually were not discovered until 1925 when a set of tentacles was collected by a Russian fish trawler. So, you know, they only got part of the animal, but, you know, they brought those pieces back and were able to determine that it was a new species. And the reason that it was so recently discovered is because the colossal squid only lives in Antarctic waters. So, of course, in the distant past, no one was down there with nets fishing for animals and therefore wouldn't have encountered any of these squid.
So how many of them are there, do we think?
Actually, I don't think that it's thought the colossal squid, are particularly rare, actually. I think mostly it is just that there's not a lot of human interaction in the area of the world that they're living in. And they do live in deeper waters. So it's not only, you know, whether or not their boat's going out there and fishing in shallow waters. They have to be fishing in deep waters in order to encounter one of these squid. But the colossal squid actually account for about 70 to 80% of sperm whale diets in the Antarctic Ocean. So they actually must be pretty common if sperm whales are relying on them for much of their food intake.
Oh, wow. So a sperm whale can eat a 770-pound squid.
Well,
that boggles the mind.
I guess so. I'm not totally sure about that. Sperm whales actually have pretty small mouths, if you think about it.
Oh, yeah.
So they're certainly going to take parts of them. And I think, actually, you know, interactions between sperm whales and colossal squid and also sperm whales and giant squid, because they eat those as well, I think those have partly led into these old fishermen's tales about, you know, the Kraken kind of thing, because sperm whale and a giant squid or a colossal squid, they're both very large animals. They're going to have quite a fight. You know, one's trying to eat the other one is trying to save itself. And so, you know, some of these things might actually get kind of moved up to the surface. And if people in the past saw these from, you know, sailing ships, they would most certainly not be expecting that. And, you know, and then as the stories are passed from person to person, they get, you know, bigger and yeah, more exciting until it's the squid was attacking the ship. But, you know, we can kind of see where some of these stories may have come from.
Right, hence the movies that we love.
Yes.
So there's a difference between a colossal squid and a giant squid, technically.
Right, yes. So they're actually in different families of squid that are not necessarily close related to each other, other than, of course, they fall within the squid. The giant squid is actually generally thought of as smaller than the colossal squid. They have, if you took a giant squid and a colossal squid of the same mantle length, the giant squid would have a smaller sort of circumference of the mantle, and the colossal squid would be larger. The giant squid has much longer arms and tentacles relative to the mantle length or the body length.
You know, just looking at the pictures of this colossal squid that was caught, I saw that beak, and that looked pretty fearsome. Are they dangerous?
Oh, no, not at all. They're not dangerous. Most of the time, you're only going to see them when they come to the surface, and they're either dead or dying at that point, whether it was from an interaction with a sperm whale or, you know, other natural causes. So it's not something that's ever going to cause any harm to humans.
Stephanie Bush studies squid, the gentle squid, at the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, and we're talking about this gigantic, colossal squid, 770-pounder, that was dissected yesterday. Stephanie, thank you.
Thanks, Alan.
Jolie Myers is here now. What do you think about that? That idea of the sperm whale and the squid engaged in this fearsome battle.
It's the most metal thing I have ever heard. I wanted to hear like Slayer songs playing in the background while I watched it. And we did tweet out a picture of that. Not the fight, because that would be spectacular. We don't have that. The squid itself, also spectacular and bonkers. Also bonkers, monuments, believe it. We talked about controversial monuments. There are some that are even more controversial than the Eisenhower Monument. There's this Second World War monument in Bulgaria. It's a bronze of a bunch of soldiers. But in 2011, the soldiers were painted over with superhero costumes, which was controversial. There's also something called the Monument of Rebirth in Romania. It's supposed to represent the overthrow of the dictator there in 1989, but it's become known as a potato on a stick.
Hmm.
So that and the RoboCop statue in Detroit. That one's my personal favorite.
Yeah, that's a great one. Okay, well, if you want to weigh in with your favorite memorial, we'd love to hear from you on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. We're also on Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Jolie Myers, thank you very much.
Of course.
And coming up next, Warren Olney and To The Point. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks a lot for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.